Talk Back with Gary Knoll, Sundays at 8 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time on the Progressive Radio Network.
Live from New York City, it's the Gary Knoll Show. And now, your host, Gary Knoll.
I'm Gary Knoll, and I'd like to welcome you to this program. I love gospel music. Grew up in a small community, and just down the street from where I lived, on Clay Street, was a Black Baptist church. And I had a lot of friends that were African American, so I'd go down there. And never would you hear that kind of singing with the rhythm and the pulse and the energy of it as you would, except from that Baptist church. So that's where I got a lot of my interest in music. That and rockabilly and hillbilly music. Today, on our program, we're going to take a look at preventing age-related cognitive decline. I'll be sharing the thoughts and research of Dr. Lori Barclay from Life Extension. Also on cortisol, a lot of people are stressed, chronically stressed. In fact, some people walk around always stressed. You pay a price for that. The stress hormones, like cortisol, will cause illness, speed up the aging process. So what can we do to keep those levels of stress hormones in check? I'll share the latest on why, how you're thinking about issues, how you're processing information is very important. And I'll be contributing to this conversation from Dr. Edward Rosnick as well. When you consider how many Americans are suffering from memory loss, the beginning of memory loss in their 30s and early 40s, and then progressing from there, we're dealing with over half the entire population, so it's a big topic. I will be taking calls through the entire program. No guests, no investigative reports. Got two of those coming up this week, very important ones, so I hope you listen in. One will be on the politics of cancer. One will also be on the lack of safety of the ingredients in vaccines. And this is the single most comprehensive in-depth report ever given, and it will be published up on our website, on what actually goes into a vaccine. Things you're not aware of. You're familiar with mercury in some, like the flu and H1N1. You're familiar with formaldehyde, embalming fluid, polysorbate 80, some aluminum product, but all the other things you're not aware of. So I'm going to take you step by step how vaccines are actually made, and then you can look up in the immunological literatures we have and see that, wow, we're putting this into our bodies? Where's the real science to prove this isn't harmful? Well, not only is there no science to prove it's not harmful, there's a great deal of science proving that it is. I'll be sharing that with you, because there's an enormous movement out there of parents who do not trust the CDC, the FDA, the pediatricians, because they have been manipulated and lied to. They see completely healthy children, after their series of vaccines, having all forms of problems, including up to full-spectrum autism. And they're saying it was the vaccines. But no one wants to acknowledge this. Well, we will give you more information. So let's begin. Our number is 888-874-4888. Now, here's the criteria I would ask you to think about before you call in. Will the question and the answer to that question help motivate, empower all listeners in the audience? that's the type of questions we like to get, one that we can all benefit from. So if you have any of those comments or questions, please call us. Green tea, confirmed as a weight loss nutrient and as a heart-healthy antioxidant. Now, this is from the Journal of Agricultural Food Chemistry. And also, there was a separate article on green tea in the International Journal of Cardiology. And what they're saying is that the polyphenols, those are the active ingredients in green tea, they can lower your free radicals. That, in turn, helps minimize the damage to a specific chemical in the body called a telomere. And the length of that telomere, especially in heart cells, means that if you keep them longer, for a longer period of time, your heart lives longer. It's just that simple. Researchers from the Departments of Chemical Biology and Pharmacology and Toxicology at Rutgers University in New Jersey examined the effects of green tea supplements on obese mice known to exhibit metabolic characteristics to humans. And then they were given different diets and different amounts of the green tea bioactive catechin, EGCG. And then the next group was given nothing. And they saw that the green tea had substantial benefit. So let's say you're overweight and you took green tea. It could help you lose weight. Let's say that you have a heart problem. It could help with that heart problem. Generally from 400 to 1,000 milligrams a day of green tea. So you can't always drink that much, but you can certainly take it in a capsule, and that's what I suggest that you do. Too much television can give you diabetes. This is from Harvard School of Public Health. Researchers show that the more television you watch, the more risk of type 2 diabetes and cardiovascular disease and premature death. Here's what Professor Hu, Professor of Nutrition Epidemiology at Harvard School of Public Health, said. Quote, the message is simple. Cutting back on TV watching can significantly reduce the risk of type 2 diabetes, heart disease, and premature mortality, meaning death. We should not only promote increased physical activity levels, but also reduce sedentary behavior, especially prolonged TV watching. This is not the first study, by the way, to show the adverse effect of watching television, but it's also true when people are spending a lot of time on their computers. It's the same sedentary lifestyle, so we need to do things that are far more active. My suggestion is this. Not everyone's going to exercise as they should, but if you broke your exercise into two times a day, in the morning and in the early evening, let's say you finish work before you have dinner, that's when you exercise the second time. Now let's say you can't do an hour. Do a half hour, but vigorous. And if you could do some cross training, let's say some jogging or power walking, or put it into really your greatest resistance on a speed bike, anything like this where you're using muscle groups and you're using cardio, well, that will help tremendously because it does three things. First, it helps to lower your pulse rate. It speeds it up while you're exercising, but then it strengthens your pulse, strengthens your heart, and then when you're resting, your pulse, instead of being at 75 beats per minute, well, maybe it will be at 60. Well, that by itself could add up to 15 years onto the life expectancy of your heart. Then you're secreting more endorphins. You're creating a better balance between dopamine and serotonin, so you're going to feel better. Now, these hormones generally will last at an elevated level anywhere from 4 to 8 hours in your body. That means if you exercise it twice a day, you'll be feeling good all day and into the evening as well. Also, you'll get a better night's sleep and your metabolism will actually be different at night. Now, normally our metabolism goes down about 10% because we're resting, we're lying down. Your blood pressure goes down, your blood sugar goes down, you're cleansing, detoxifying. But when you are able to have a better exercise, you're able to get a better night's sleep, and you detoxify faster. And all that is good. So, one more reason to stop all the television and start exercising. Now, desk jobs, in a similar study that was published in the Journal of the American Medical Association, the desk job can actually send you to an early grave. That's the bad news for those of you who work in these cubicles or sit behind a desk for long periods of time. And what they found is they looked at 200,000 men and women, and they found that the longer people sit each day, the greater the chances of going into an early grave. When you exercise, and that makes all the difference in the world, then that extends your life. Those who sat for more than 10 hours a day had a 48% increased risk of death compared to more active people who sat for less than 4 hours a day. This was done at the University of Sydney School of Public Health, and it says, quote, your lowest risk of death is if you are physically active and don't sit. Your highest risk of is if you don't do any physical activity and you sit a lot of the day. And that's serious. So, one more reason to get up and exercise. Fish consumption linked to lower diabetes and cardiovascular risk. This is from Medical News, mainstream journal. And this is done at the University of Valencia. And it says, people who regularly eat fish as their primary source of animal protein have lower blood glucose concentrations and a reduced risk of developing diabetes and cardiovascular disease compared to other people. Well, that's important. Now, anyone who's been in the Mediterranean, and of course this study was in the Mediterranean, know that they do slow cooking and even slower eating. They also don't rush any meal at all. I've seen people take 3 hours for their afternoon meal and 2 hours for the evening meal because they do a lot of socializing. They love to eat out. And I remember it was, we had driven, a bunch of us, very fast to go from Venice to a nearby city to watch an opera, an outdoor opera, without microphones. And it was this big Colosseum-like structure. Verona is where it was. And normally it would have taken, I think, 4 hours. We made it an hour and a half. They were going like 160 miles an hour because there's no speed limit. I just kind of sat back in the back of the car and thought, whoa, you don't have an accent. Well, we didn't. And after the opera, we were walking down these wonderful, beautiful streets, and it was 11 o'clock at night, and people were going out for their evening meal. And I saw, is this because they just finished watching the opera? And the guy said, no. Here, people go out for a small meal late at night. Well, we don't do that in the United States. By 11 o'clock, most people are at home watching television or asleep. Interesting how slowing down the pace of life makes all the difference in the world. And I remember when we were driving through the Italian countryside, especially near the ocean down by Naples. In fact, we went over to the island of Capri, which is very pretty. And there was harvesting in August, some of the wheat. And I remember just sitting under a tree and closing my eyes and listening. And I could feel the warm August breeze. I could feel, you can hear the wheat hitting each other. It's kind of this like subtle clapping sensation. But it was just this historical feeling. Only other time I ever had that was down at my ranch in Texas, where at nighttime I would go out and walk around the property and I'd look up at the big sky. They call Montana and Texas big sky country because is everything so bright at night. You don't have pollution. You don't have light pollution. And you have this eternal sense of connection. It's an awesome feeling. You're alone, you're looking up at the sky, and you're realizing that someone 200 years ago, a settler, a rancher, looked up at the same sky. And it gives that timeless sense that you are part of this whole inner wave of life. And I had that same feeling sitting in the fields out in Italy. And what I notice is that they work at an even pace. They start earlier than most Americans work. They take a long lunch, generally 4 hours. They take a break. Then they work again. And they go back and work until almost it's dark, 7, 8 o'clock. And then they take another break. And then they have a late small meal. And if you even hear their conversation, it's a non-rush conversation. Just watching people do things. And I love to do that. I love to see how people live day to day, throughout a day. And you see how they look at each other and how they speak with each other. That's all a part of the Mediterranean lifestyle. And that contributes to a longer life. It's not just fish consumption. A whole lot more going on there. But if you do live the Mediterranean life, you're going to have less hypertension. You will have a longer life expectancy. You will be less likely to develop cardiovascular disease and type 2 diabetes. That's the conclusion of that article. That's also one of the reasons I'd like to see more people getting out to the country and living a country life. In fact, there was an article. I was going to deal with this tomorrow. And if I can find it, I'll... Oh, here it is. This is from Fran Corton. Young Farmers, a Growing Movement. I'll quote this. It's from Yes Magazine. In spite of the daily discouraging environment in political and economic news, the living things that we do not pay attention to are more interesting and not just for the more natural folks. Recently during lunch at Yes offices, online editor Brooke Jarvis made a casual comment I found quite stunning. Brooke, a sharp, talented 20-something, said, "I don't know how a single person under 30 who doesn't want to own a farm." "What? Own a farm?" I turned to several 20-somethings at the table and asked if they agreed. They did. They waxed eloquently about their love for lambs, ducks, chickens, bees. They confessed they weren't sure they would ever actually own a farm, but their yearning was definitely real. What the people at the fair shared in common was not their politics, but their optimism. I think that just 5 years ago, the 20-somethings in our office were not longing to own a farm. Something in our culture is changing. A growing segment of people don't want to buy just organic, healthy food. They want to grow it. This new lust to farm seems to cross class, race, and politics. For example, Robert Jeffrey, an African-American pastor in Seattle, started Clean Greens Farms to bring produce to the inner city, where fresh food is hard to find. He's gotten a tremendous response from young people of all races ready to get their hands in the dirt. Another sign comes from the just-launched Mother Earth News Fairs, inspired by interest in the how-to of growing your own. At the recent fair near Seattle, a crowd of more than 10,000 attended workshops on everything from canning to beekeeping to building the perfect chicken coop. So, my thoughts on this. I'm glad to see this happening. In fact, just this evening, just before starting this program, I spoke with a friend I haven't seen in, oh, I guess 4 or 5 years, an artist who is now living on a ranch, a horse ranch, out north in Northern California, about an hour north of San Francisco. And this is a person who said, "Sorry, I haven't been in touch, but I just decided I don't want to hear any bad news about what's going on with anything. And I just am happy to be close to nature and growing some food and doing some things that are important to me, that give me happiness. Book binding for small publishers and doing refinishing of furniture. And all I see every day is nature, beauty, animals. It's a simple life. It's a quiet life. But at this point in my life, this is exactly what I need." Now, Gary, you're different. A lot of people rely upon you to keep them up to date on what's happening and what movements are out there and how to become more socially active. And this person said, "But as an artist, it's too stressful for me. I get burned up. I become overly sensitive emotionally to all these different crises and issues. And I'm finding my balance right now. And I thought, good for that person, because not everyone should be out there and joining the ranks, because some people will burn out. We have to know when we're ready, when we're physically, mentally, spiritually, intellectually, and creatively ready to join a cause, and then we can contribute to it and not be destroyed because of it. I see a lot of casualties, psychic casualties, of getting involved in something and not knowing where the boundaries are and not having balance in their life, where it becomes all consuming. And then one day you forget about the things that at one time were important to you, like slow food and nice conversations and going for walks and thinking about just sitting under trees and enjoying nature, you know, looking at it for what it is, spending time in a museum, because we're so focused on if we leave the battle for a second, somehow we'll be out of the loop. Well, there's always been battles, there always will be battles, and all any of us can do at any given time is contribute what we can to them. But then we have to let that go, hope that others take on that and go on with our lives. Otherwise, we have no life. All we have are battles. And you should be measured by more than the things you own, the company you keep, or the battles that you're engaged in. Otherwise, you end up just burned out. In any case, what I'm going to be doing is, in the very near future, I'm going to be closing on a major piece of property, and I'm going to have 5 villages, 18th century style villages. One is an artisan's village, one is a food village, one is a remarkable mind village, where people, all they do is think about the issues, analyze issues, and share how we can deal with this. Well, when it comes to getting back to the land, we have more people right now wanting to take that step. And what do they need to do then? What tools do they need? What skills do they need in order to make a transition from where they're at to that more pastoral, beautiful, natural environment? And right now, there's more and more of the workshops going on, because it's a movement. It's a gigantic movement. There's probably in the United States about 5 million people. Around the world, probably 50 million people who are actively engaged in this. And we're sharing information. So when I do something, because I'm going to have a giant water mill that will, one that looks like it's in the 17th century out of Holland, but it's going to be producing electricity, as are wind and solar and other and geothermal and other energy input. But then you get the latest technology from other people, and then you share this. Each person shares, and you put it up there. So everyone's sharing. One common cause: for those who choose to remove themselves from the grid, we now have very viable movements to do it. And we're all of one mind. We want to live a longer and healthier life and share that with as many people as possible. So there's a great deal of optimism going on. And it's unfortunate that too many people get stuck in the cities and don't have the chance to get out of the cities or out of the inner ghettos of many cities, because there's a wonderful world out there. I'll let you all know when it's closer to fruition or it's done. I'm going to be taking calls in a moment at 888-874-4888, 888-874-4888. Now, here's the last couple of things. I believe we should be taking vitamin C in different amounts every day based upon what we actually need. For example, if you're traveling, or if you're under stress, or if you've had a sunburn, or if you've been staying up late and working, if you've been around a polluted environment, if you've eaten some bad food, you need more vitamin C. This is from the American Heart Association. Low vitamin C levels may raise heart failure patients' risks. Quote, low levels of vitamin C were associated with higher levels of high-sensitivity C-reactive protein and shorter intervals without major cardiac issues or death for heart failure patients. So we should be taking a lot more vitamin C. And each person is different. I suggest that we start at 1,000 milligrams a day in buffered form. You might divide that in two 500 milligram doses and then graduate up 500 milligrams at a time until you reach bowel tolerance. And then the largest amount you should take is before you go to bed at night, because it really does you a lot of good, helping the body detoxify and speeding up the cleansing process. So in the morning, your body is able to evacuate a lot of the toxins, dead cells, and undigested oligocellulose out of your body. In effect, you're cleansing your system. And vitamin C is very important in helping that. Now, I get a lot of calls on bioidentical hormones. I'm very much supportive of bioidentical hormones. I am absolutely against synthetic hormones. There's a lot of scientific literature demonstrating the harmful effects of non-bioidentical hormones and how it leads women to end up causing imbalances. For example, 13 studies document that non-bioidentical hormones, such as progestin, significantly increases estrogen-stimulated breast cell replication and growth. In stark contrast, 7 studies have shown that bioidentical progesterone does not induce estrogen-stimulated breast cell proliferation. And numerous studies have demonstrated an increased risk of breast cancer with use of non-bioidentical progestins. However, the use of bioidentical progesterone has not been associated with an increased risk of breast cancer. Quite the contrary. Research has revealed that bioidentical progesterone decreases the risk of breast cancer. In a study published in the journal Breast Cancer Research and Treatment, 80,000 postmenopausal women using various forms of hormone replacement therapy were followed for 8 years. Women who used estrogen in combination with non-bioidentical progestins had a 69% increased risk of breast cancer compared to women who had never used hormone replacement therapy. However, for women who used bioidentical progesterone in combination with estrogen, the increased risk of breast cancer was completely eliminated, and with a significant reduction in breast cancer risk compared to non-bioidentical progestin use. So all the science is on behalf of the biological way of approaching it, not the synthetic. So non-biological hormones are not identical to the hormones naturally produced within the body. The use of non-bioidentical estrogen and progesterone is associated with increased risk of breast cancer, heart attack, and stroke, where bioidentical hormones have the same molecular structure as the hormones produced naturally within the body. The body does not distinguish between supplemental bioidentical hormones and the hormones produced within the body. As a result, bioidentical hormones are properly utilized and are able to be naturally metabolized and excreted from the body. And studies suggest that bioidentical progesterone is not associated with an increased risk of breast cancer. And current literature indicates the use of bioidentical progesterone is associated with a decreased risk of breast cancer. Now, 3 types of estrogen are produced in the body: estriol, estrione, and estradiol. And the scientific literature suggests that the use of estriol is not associated with an increased risk of breast cancer. And while non-bioidentical estrogen replacement therapy is known to increase uterine, and topical estriol is not. And research on bioidentical progesterone has shown beneficial effects on cardiovascular health, including lowered blood clots, protecting against atherosclerosis and hardening of the arteries. So estriol, E-S-T-R-I-O-L, estriol, has been shown to improve bone density, promote youthful skin, and enhance sexual and urinary health. And so you want to take the foods that have been scientifically proven to protect against developing breast cancer. That would be green tea that I mentioned earlier in the program, soy isoflavones, fish oil, vitamin D, plant lignans, indole-3 carbonyl, found in your cruciferous vegetables. That's, if you have cruciferous vegetables every day, you're doing a great deal to prevent cancers. Deglucurate, those are just some of the things that you could do that are not that difficult. So there's no reason that women should be not aware of this, but the propaganda that the American Cancer Society brings out and that the National Cancer Institute brings out would have women do just the opposite, taking mammograms, I'm opposed to that, a thermography that does not create any ionizing radiation could tell you just as quickly because it measures heat differentiation in the body, and cancers run much higher in temperature. In fact, in one investigation, researchers found a 40% increased risk of breast cancer for women who use estrogen with non-bioidentical progestins. And that's what's sold over television. That's what's promoted. That's what your doctor offers you. Rare is the doctor that offers you the bioidentical progesterone. In fact, there's a reduction in breast cancer compared to women who had never used hormone replacement therapy. In essence, bioidentical progesterone protects women against the development of breast cancer. And this has been confirmed in several separate studies. Bioidentical progesterone is very good for you. There's compelling research on all these. So we want to reduce the risk of breast cancer in women, and this is one of those situations where you have to know what it is you're taking. For example, most people don't know what progesterone is. Bioidentical natural progesterone is made in the body, or made, not extracted, in the laboratory from soybeans or the Mexican wild yam. Velosa, it's called. Dioscorea velosa. Now, the process was discovered back in the 1930s by Pennsylvania State University professor Russell Marker, who transformed diogenin from wild yams into natural progesterone. And natural progesterone refers to bioidentical hormone products that have a molecular structure identical to the hormones our bodies manufacture naturally. And one of the most effective forms of bioidentical progesterone is called micronized progesterone. The process of micronization allows for steady, even absorption of the medication. And both the micronized progesterone and other commercially available progesterone creams contain bioidentical progesterone. Now, here's what you got to be aware of. Stay away from synthetic progestins. Unlike natural progesterone, non-bioidentical synthetic progestins are not molecular identical to the hormones found naturally in the body. Synthetic progestins were first developed for use as contraceptive agents, and because the half-life of natural progesterone is very short, researchers sought an agent that would produce longer-lasting, more potent effects than natural progesterone. So birth control pills usually contain a synthetic progestin and a synthetic estrogen. And synthetic progestins are very potent, with just a small dose preventing ovulation and thus functioning as birth control. A slight change in the chemical structure of progesterone has allowed pharmaceutical companies to create patentable and highly profitable, and in my opinion, extremely dangerous birth control products. And one of the most common progestins out there is called medroxyprogesterone acetate, or Provera. Provera, and it's been linked to blood clots and fluid retention and acne and rashes and weight gain and depression and cancers and other disorders. So non-biological progestins are also able to bind to what are called the glucocorticoid and androgen and mineral corticoid receptors, which can explain the wide range and adverse side effects many women experience while taking synthetic progestins. And the vast majority of research studies have been conducted using progestins rather than natural progesterone, which helps explain the disparity and negative results. And the FDA, of course, as it always does, it approved the drugs, and one called Prometrium, or an oral pill containing 200 milligrams of natural micronized progesterone taken daily. Because orally administered progesterone is metabolized by the liver, it may be contraindicated in patients with certain liver conditions. So the best way of administering natural progesterone is as a cream. It's more efficiently used since lipophilic, meaning fat-soluble molecules, allow it to be better absorbed through the skin. And this is called transdermal administration, even better absorbed than, let's say, progesterone when it's rubbed into the mucous membrane surface, the inner aspects of labia or intervaginally, called the transmucosal administration. So just a little bit of information there to help you understand. Stay away from estriol because it's going to increase the risk of cancers. And I just want women to live longer and happier and healthier lives. And boy, have they got misinformation out of most of the official resource guides out there. I'm Gary Nall, back in a moment with your calls, 888-874-488, 888-874-4888. I'm happy to take your calls on any issue that we discuss on this program. And don't forget, the best thing all of you can do, men and women, to reduce the risk of cancer, vitamin D, get it every day. Cruciferous vegetables protect against tumor proliferation and especially estrogen metabolites. In fact, one last thing here, I read all the time scientific literature. And I can't tell you how many scientific studies now show the compounds in cruciferous vegetables, broccoli, cauliflower, Brussels sprouts, cabbage, kale, that specifically neutralize dangerous breakdown products of estrogen that promote cancer growth. And cruciferous vegetable compounds also help neutralize the many carcinogens we are inevitably exposed to each day. And one of the best studied cruciferous vegetable compounds is broccoli. And we just are not having enough of it, and we should. And we need to promote eating our cruciferous vegetables. Because when you eat your cruciferous vegetables, you have a metabolite called 2-hydroxyestrione. And that suppresses dangerous estrogen metabolites, 16-alpha-hydroxyestrione, that promotes breast and other cancers. So have your broccoli, prevent cancer, and have that estrogen converted to 2-hydroxyestrione, and then the risk of breast cancer and cancers is decreased. And soy slashes your breast cancer risk also. So that's a good one to have in there. And curcumin is also good, and the isoflavones from soy are really terrific. They do a great deal. And then the fish oil. And then D-glucarate is found in grapefruits and apples and oranges and broccoli and Brussels sprouts. And D-glucarate, G-L-U-C-A-R-A-T, glucarate, has been shown to protect against cancer-causing agents by supporting detoxification and removal of dangerous chemicals, and also by protecting against the mutating effects of these carcinogens inducing SATR DNA. So, take your D-glucarate, take your lignans, and there's no reason then that you should be as susceptible as to cancer as you are now. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. Also Twitter, and to share any thought you want to Twitter, just go to PRN underscore radio, underscores that little line. It's at PRN underscore radio, at PRN underscore radio. And we have a Twitter right now, and this says opt-out replay. Says, American comedy seems extremely vulgar and cynical. Terms such as health nut are used. Are they a force for negative sublimation? I would agree with you that a great deal of American humor is vulgar. It's aggressive. It's based upon shocking people. And I would much rather see people who are using real insight, wit, without being vulgar. It's just that right now, that's rare. Not impossible, but it's rare. No, I don't believe it affects us in any negative sublimation way. I just believe that it's something we accept automatically. Let's say hello to Paul from New Jersey. Hi, Paul.
Hi, Gary. I wanted to discuss products that are being imported, food products and nutritional products that are being imported into the U.S., and the possibility of them being contaminated with radiation. You know, just for instance, I called a manufacturer of coconut oil that I use, and the coconut oil is being imported from the Philippines, and I asked them if they were doing random tests as the product was being imported, and they said no, that the test is being done within the Philippines. So my question is there any government agency that or non-government agency that's protecting us?
Yes, there are two, the FDA and the USDA. And I would not be concerned about radiation exposure in a product like coconut oil, especially from the Philippines or Southeast Asia. I would be concerned about products coming in, including manufactured products, including parts of cars, from radiation exposure in Japan for three reasons. One, because the Japanese government has intentionally understated the amount of radiation that's actually been emitted from Fukushima. Two, that they are now finding the unacceptably high levels of radiation in soil and water, and hence in food, including in their large food belt area, even hot spots all over Japan and all over Tokyo. Well, anything that you're manufacturing would also be exposed to the radiation, and once irradiated, it's never unirradiated. You can't take the radiation out of something once it's in it. I believe that any product, including component products, because not all cars, for example, are made as entire cars, parts of them are. I believe then that we should just get a radiation monitor, a simple Geiger counter, and check for ourselves. That's what tens of thousands of homemakers, women, have done all over Japan because they couldn't get any straight answers from the government. So this way, you at least know what you're getting. That's what I would do. All the best to you. And let's say hello to Camille from Long Island. Hi, Camille.
Hi, Gary. How are you?
Good.
Good. I'm doing well myself. I've made some major changes, and I like to make a radical change and follow a complete vegan diet. I have hypoglycemia, and I also take inositol as a supplement. And I'm concerned about how to balance my carbs and my proteins with the hypoglycemia. I know the old school diet was high protein, and on a vegan diet, I get a lot of my protein from legumes and grains. And I was just wondering, should I be adding more tofu and other soy products to benefit the protein level?
I don't know what sources and how much of each one you're having, but back it all for a moment, because hypoglycemia has many different causes. Underactive thyroid is one. Mm-hmm. Common food allergies is another. Lack of exercise and an excessive intake of refined carbohydrates. There's many reasons. Even some are viral associated, Epstein-Barr virus. Now, we think of that associated with chronic fatigue syndrome, but a lot of people walk around even after eating without all the energy they should have, and therefore they have some subclinical viral episodes or bacterial episodes that aren't manifesting as full alt-right-out viral or bacterial infections, but they're always there because the person never completely rebalanced their system. Hence, ozone treatment is one good way to wipe out bacteria and viruses in the body. A second is to go on to a high alkaline diet. And third is to look carefully at where did we get this myth that everything has to be high protein if you have hypoglycemia. This was started in the 1970s by Carlton Fredericks over on WR. He had a radio show, a very popular radio show, mainly with older people. And his big deal was eat organic or range-fed meat, have a small 5-milligram B-complex, and have fiber. And unfortunately, there were very few people in the entire field of health who were actually healthy at that time. Bernard Jensen was an exception. Pavel Arola was an exception. Dr. Walker was an exception. There were just a handful, but the vast majority, Joe Bonomo and Bob Hoffman and Belila Morales and Dadell Davis and Lelore Cordell, Catherine Elwood, Carlton Fredericks, all these people, I knew them all, and they were all, I was very young, I was just a kid, but they were all smoking, not all smoke, but a lot of them smoked. They had a terrible diet, and but it was just high protein, and almost everything was considered hypoglycemia. There was one doctor in New York City, every single patient he saw, he would determine they had hypoglycemia. Well, they didn't, and I saw a lot of the people that he saw that never got better. So first, a protein is what? It's a building block. It's made up of amino acids. There are different types of amino acids. Some are essential, meaning the body cannot create them, so we have to take them in. And there are 8 essential and 1, if you're pregnant, extra. And then there are non-essential. Now, a amino acid from meat is identical to the amino acid from rice. The difference is the meat will give you some iron, no fiber, more often than not today, growth-stimulating hormones, antibiotics, pesticide residues, all of which are part of that animal's life, and a lot of bacteria. The rice will give you endosperm, fiber, B-complex, and a complete assortment of all 8 essential amino acids. So then, if you're going to have to get, let's say, 9/10 of a gram per kilogram of body weight per day of protein, do you want to get that for you if you're a woman, and what's your weight? Hello, Camille?
Yes, I'm 155.
155. How tall are you?
I'm 5'5".
Okay, well, you're about 20 pounds overweight.
I am, and I'm exercising, and I'm doing everything I can, and it's slowly coming off.
Good. That's good. Well, then you should have about 120, excuse me, you should have about, at for an ideal weight of about 120, you should have about 45 grams protein a day spread out in 3 different meals. Like, so let's say 15 in the morning, 15 in the afternoon, 15 in the early evening.
Mm-hmm.
Don't take all your protein at once. A lot of people try to do that because, and bodybuilders and athletes are particularly guilty of this, they take too much protein at one time. The body has no mechanism for storing protein, so it's broken down into amino acids, and it's what's called deaminization, and it creates urea and ammonium, two very toxic chemicals in the body, creates too much toxic reaction in the liver, too much toxic reaction in the kidneys. So high protein diets are really bad for you. They're bad for everyone.
Okay.
So
one
get
more
your
thing,
get your, hold on a second. Get your protein from your grains,
okay,
nuts, seeds, and beans.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that's the best way of getting them.
Okay. Gary, I do take inositol as one of my supplements. And does that affect your blood sugar in any way? I know it has a sweet flavor.
It doesn't affect the blood sugar as much as it affects your mood. And
okay,
also, it's important as part of one of the stimulators for our brain chemistry, along with
right,
choline.
Right.
So, no, that won't affect the blood sugar. If you want to do something good for yourself, take some cinnamon capsules. Take
okay,
2 in the morning, 2 in the afternoon, 2 in the evening.
Excellent. Thank you
all
so
right,
much, Gary. I appreciate
all,
it.
All the best. Fran from New Jersey, you're on, Fran.
Hello?
Hi.
Hi. Yes, I heard that you have garlic is good for you, and I heard from a 2 different sources on the web that they're bad for you. Garlic and onions are poison for the system.
Mm-hmm.
So who do I believe?
Well, where I grew up in West Virginia, we were told that if we wore a rubber band around our penis, we couldn't get a woman pregnant. I think the same person is talking to you through the web.
It's a doctor.
I don't care who it is. The person is simply misinformed. There are over 5,000 studies in the peer-reviewed literature on just the sulfur compounds, the alpha sulfur compounds, lowering your blood pressure, helping prevent cancer, stopping free radicals that would destroy your DNA, helping antiviral, antibacterial activity, helping to kill parasites. They are helping with joint pain, helping create de-inflammation chemicals in the body. To the contrary, garlic is simply one of nature's most perfect foods, and anyone who's not aware of that is simply unaware, and I would hate to think what other misinformation that doctor was giving to that person, to their patients. Doctors not trained in health. They're not trained in psychology. They're not trained in human dynamics. They're not trained in the environmental issues we're facing today, like global warming. If I asked the average physician, name me the 12 tipping points, they couldn't name one. And no, don't mention global warming. That's not one. If I were to ask them to talk about who today is the head of the new government in Italy, they couldn't tell me. And they couldn't tell me that that person's background was he came from being on the steering committee of the Bilderberg Group and also was closely linked with the Council on Foreign Relations. This is an insider's insider. And not a single person currently in the government's ruling party in their new ruling cabinet was elected. That's unusual in a democracy to have no one elected. And yet they would not know this. So what they do know is they know pathology. They're well-trained in the pathology of a particular series of diseases based upon their specialization. Now, I wouldn't go into their office and suggest that I would know how to diagnose a glioma or a macular degeneration. Why do they feel they have the right to come into a field that many of us, myself included, have spent all of our lives clinically, in laboratories, as a professor in the classroom, teaching this, reading, preparing, writing, doing clinical studies, doing at least 47 clinical studies where we use things like garlic. But that's the hubris, that's the arrogance, that's the conceit of the medical community today. And why do you think I did my multi-award-winning documentary, 58 awards thus far this year, Death by Medicine, and wrote a book to go with it? Because here we have the number one cause of death in the United States. Not cancer, not stroke, not heart attacks. It is medicine, iatrogenesis. Mine is the lowest, most conservative figure. And it's still more than any other cause. The highest one is from Harvard, and it could go to 1 million people a year killed. And then upwards of 19 million injured. And yet not a single meeting anywhere in medicine to discuss this phenomena. You think maybe they don't want to look at the truth of what they're not doing for us? So it doesn't surprise me that someone would make a statement as absurd as not to ever take garlic as bad for you when it goes against all the science, which they're completely unfamiliar with. It goes against clinical experience, which obviously they haven't included. Fran, thank you for your call. All the best.
Thank you very much.
I'm Gary Noll, and that's all the time we have. Have a nice day, everyone. See you tomorrow at noon.